Turning now to Psalm 27. Psalm 27 and verse 1. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? And the subject is David on felt union with God. For whatsoever things were written aforetime, were written for our learning, that we, through patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope. Romans 15:4, one of the great New Testament rules of interpretation for the Old Testament. And remember those words as we come into this psalm. Now, just by way of introduction, often the assumption is made that this psalm must have been written during the course of the rebellion of Absalom. And the idea, therefore, is that David, betrayed on every hand and in deep trouble, and humanly speaking, looking as though he was going to lose his kingdom and so on, that in those circumstances he makes this desperate appeal to God and affirms his own trust in God to give him military victory. And in the course of the psalm, assuming that he's away, of course, as he would be during the last stages of the rebellion of Absalom, he's away and longing to be home, back in Jerusalem and in the house of God. He casts his mind forward and longs for the time when he'll be back in the temple and pledges himself to be there for the rest of his life. So that's the general assumption about this psalm. And indeed, some of the modern translations, most notably the New International Version, have decided that it must be interpreted that way, and therefore the whole rendering will be slanted in that direction. And if you read the NIV on Psalm 27, it's quite beautifully rendered, but you would think, be absolutely sure, that this is all about David in time of war, away from Jerusalem, longing to be home, afraid and longing for victory, and nothing else. And it's located only in that situation. Well, that isn't the case. And that is one of the reasons why I think the New International Version can't be particularly recommended, because the translators very often do act as interpreters, and they make up their mind what a psalm or passage is about, and then they tend to help us out, so they think. They do it in all sincerity. They're not dishonest men. They slant the translation, the rendering, in that direction. And so you can see nothing else. You would never see what this psalm, as I'm going to try to put across this evening, is really about from their rendering, because it gives it one sense and meaning and one only. And they're not alone in that. That is a modern tendency. And in the case of Psalm 27, the translator, whoever he was, had got the interpretation wrong, I believe, anyway. And he'd made that mistake. The sole object of the psalm isn't just to pray for victory in a great battle and then one day get back to Jerusalem. So having made that mistake and simplifying the psalm in line with his interpretation, he has ceased to be a translator and become an interpreter. And that's our King James Version may have its difficulties from being so old and its archaisms and so on, but it seldom does that, makes that mistake. And it's very straightforward with us here. And this will be plainer, I hope, as we go. Now, it may have been penned during the time of Absalom's rebellion, but it doesn't say so. And it isn't the only way to look at the psalm. It may have a very difficult and fearful background, but it shouldn't be tilted wholly in that direction. David's psalms, again, it's a bit of an extended introduction, they're wonderfully constructed. They're not just a bundle or a bag of disconnected thoughts. I looked at one don't want to give the impression they're all like this, but I looked at one study Bible, and there's a title put over the psalm. Ah, I thought, well, the editors have made up their mind that that is the sense or the chief subject of the psalm. But then when you look through the comments, almost every comment suggested another subject, another title. And altogether, there was a title on the top, and then the headings of the psalm were given quite different, unconnected aims and objectives. And they didn't relate to each other. So you had a psalm which was a bundle of unconnected themes, as though David couldn't hold his point and kept lurching from one point to another as he went through. One thing you can always be sure of with these Psalms of David is that they are wonderfully constructed. They are, of course, inspired by God. And while there may be different themes and ideas introduced, and we have to watch out for it, there is most generally a uniting theme and a purpose. And you can see it's logical and it's sequential. You can see what it's all about. And so we have to look at a psalm like this and say, what is the chief topic or subject? And when we think we've got it, we will be confirmed as being correct if everything else fits in with that and relates to it and builds that theme or point up. And that's what we must look for the sense, the chief sense in the psalm. Now, you might think, if you just glance through the psalm, that it is about war and fear and need of the help of God in war. But then as you look more carefully, you find there is another theme which is actually more important than that and rises above that, and fear of war and battle is subservient to it. And I'll try and explain it briefly before we get on. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? It starts with a warning that it's a spiritual psalm. The Lord is my light and my salvation, the strength of my life. We'll come to that, but look down at verse 4. One thing have I desired of the Lord, and the sense of the original is not just one thing, but this is the chief thing that I have desired of the Lord. That will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. This is deeply spiritual language. It mustn't merely be brushed off as though David is away from home and he's longing to get back and to go into the temple and see beautiful things. This is a paramount point here. One thing have I desired of the Lord. And we have to look at this. What is he telling us? What does it mean? I'll mention in a moment. And this deeply mystical fifth verse. For in the time of trouble, he shall hide me in his pavilion. This doesn't fit the thesis that he's a long way from the house of God and wants to get back there. In the time of trouble, he shall hide me in his pavilion, and I'll explain the meaning of that word, which is very unusual. In the secret of his tabernacle shall he hide me. He shall set me up upon a rock. This is spiritual language. It doesn't fit being away from home and longing to get back and just see the temple. He's saying something else. And we can look at other verses too. If we glance through, down at verse 8, when thou saidst, seek ye my face, my heart said unto thee, thy face, Lord, will I seek. Now this is the language of extremely close, intimate contact with God that David uses here. And similarly in verse 9, and closeness is repeated by the figure in verse 10 of the care of father and mother being compared with that of the Lord. And as you look through, but it'll confirm as we go through, I mustn't spend time with this, there is a theme which is more important than war. You realise the overriding subject is spiritual union. It is closeness to God. And this is the answer of fear of enemies. Fear of enemies is really secondary to this. This is the prevailing thing, closeness to God, and everything else will fall into perspective. And so we'll look at the psalm on that basis, and we'll divide it into parts in the expectation that the parts will all serve the topic. Now the divisions are easy. Verses 1 to 6, this will be enough of technical analysis. Verses 1 to 6 are an affirmation of the supreme value of close union with God. Personally, as an individual believer, close union with God. All these things are really an affirmation of its importance and its great value. And verses 7 to 12 are clearly a prayer, with only one verse that might be an exception. They're a prayer. They're addressed to the Lord. And they are to be seen as prayers for union with God. And then verses 13 and 14, well, verse 13 is a closing word of testimony, and verse 14 an exhortation. It may be addressed by David to himself, or it may be addressed by David to everyone who will read and sing the psalm, which is more likely. So you've got an affirmation of the supreme importance and value and preciousness of union with God, and then you've got a prayer for it. That's most of the psalm, those two things, and then just a verse of testimony and a verse of exhortation on the end. So we can call the psalm David teaching on felt or close union with God. Actually, the word felt perhaps is not a very safe word to use, because it may suggest that you can feel God, which of course you cannot do, as I'm sure you all appreciate. You come into the presence of God, you do not feel his presence. You cannot sense his presence. That is impossible for you. When we speak of felt union, all our union with God is by faith. What we mean by felt is that it has a profound effect on us. And we certainly feel that. We feel the effect that close union with God has on us. We do not feel his presence, as though there'll be a tingling or a change in temperature or a strange change in perceived atmosphere or mood or a touch or a voice. There is no physical perception of nearness to God, but there is certainly a perception, because it brings comforts which we certainly feel and joy which we certainly feel, and it clears our view of things remarkably to have been in the presence of God, and our perspective, and it increases our faith, and it shames away our sin. We cannot be in close union with God in prayer and then freely and easily move into sin or plan it. It shames it away, and then it brings assurance, and of course it brings the solid evidence of answered prayer. And so we prize union with the Lord and addressing him and expressing our love to him and praising him and thanking him very specifically for many things and calling upon him as one who is living, all-powerful and close to us. Close union with God. We tell him we love him. We tell him what we owe him. We tell him what we need. We worship privately and personally and feel it. We meditate before him about these things. We seek and ask for close union, not so that we feel anything physically perceived in touch, but so that we shall have these spiritual benefits and blessings, and we certainly feel those. And David is talking about this. So in that context we go to the first verse. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Now, I read, this was a comment, someone who's comment on the verses of the in the NIV, which translates it something like, second part of the verse, the Lord is the stronghold of my life. Well, that can be done. The word strength can be taken as stronghold. You see the slanting that's going on. It isn't necessarily You could say, well, in this context, it means the defence of my life or the stronghold of my life, so that you begin to insert military defensive words all the way through the psalm, which aren't an essential translation. That's not what the original says. It could be. It can be taken that way. But if you do that consistently, then you just make war the whole theme of the psalm. And it isn't, that's not right. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Not necessarily, it would include this. If there is war, not necessarily the one who could bring me through this war. Whom shall I fear? I ought to remind you that, of course, the wars fought by David were wars fought at God's command, defences made at God's command, wars that were under a particular promise of God. This was the defence of his people. And this is representative of a spiritual warfare. We are unlikely to be involved in a war, wherever we may live, which is something which we can be certain is under the direction of God, and we are the innocents, and the enemy is the one who is going to be given an assured victory by God. You will never know that today. These circumstances are unique, that here was a command to war given to David by God, and the promise that he would be defended victoriously when attacked. So the language of David's Psalms speaks about war in this very confident way. If he puts his faith in God and looks to him for guidance, he will get victory. Now, how can that be applied to the Christian life after the time of David, to us today? Well, only as a figure for the spiritual warfare. It is only in the spiritual warfare that we are given the guarantee and the promise, the solid promise of God, that the victory will be ours if we fight that war with following his commands and believe his promises and have faith in him and pray, then the devil, who is our enemy, whatever agents he uses in the world, who bring us under temptation and try to lure us away from God, well, we shall win these conflicts. Time and time again. So you always, these things are for our learning. But the situation that was unique to David is applied to us in spiritual terms. The Lord is my light. What a term. I'm going to have to go quickly. The Lord is my light. This is your experience when you come to Christ, when you're converted. You look at this world before you're converted, and however you regard things, you can't understand it. You can't understand why, whatever people do, there are always wars, inequality, extortion, trouble, unfairness, lies. Why these things go on? Good times, bad times, times when things are done properly and things go in an orderly way, then it all collapses. Times when some people do good things and nobody appreciates it, and everybody wants to turf them out and rebel against it. I'm not talking about current situations, by the way. But you can't understand it. But when you're converted, you can understand it all, because you understand the principle of the fall and sin in the heart and the depravity of man and the great conflict in society and in the world and this spiritual conflict and the enemy of souls drawing people away, ever bringing in alternative morality and bringing people further away from God. You can see it all. It's plain as anything. But so are passing situations, temporary situations. The Lord is my light. You see everything in new eyes. You have a new world view. You have a new perspective on everything. So we can see exactly what he means. The Lord is my light. I wouldn't go back to where I was, where everything was utterly confusing, where I couldn't understand why things happened as they do. I wouldn't go back to that, where I couldn't understand people and how they behaved and why they behaved. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whether it's David's salvation from war, or whether it's our salvation from sin and fall, and our victory in serving the Lord in whatever capacity, whom shall I fear? But look, the emphasis is on the Lord in the way the words are constructed in the Hebrew. The Lord is my light. Now that's why our translators chose the word strength rather than the word stronghold or fortress or defence. The Lord is the strength of my life. The King James translators avoided bottlenecking, saying, well, this probably refers specifically to a fortress, so we'll render it fortress. And they stayed with the root term, strength or defence. The Lord is the strength of my life. It has very broad application. He, to be close to him. Can you see the point is coming in very early in the psalm? Not the Lord will arrange for me to be strong, or the Lord will supply me with light, or the Lord will give me salvation. It doesn't say that. It says the Lord is my light and my salvation. In other words, I'm worried out of my mind. Something is threatening me. Something I can't accomplish. Something which is going wrong. Something which is deeply disturbing and distressing. Just get into the presence of the Lord. That's the sense of the verse. Get into the presence of the Lord. Spend time with him. Lay it before him. Praise him. Adore him. Reflect on his goodness in his presence. He is your peace and your strength and your understanding. That's what the psalmist is saying. So it starts on a deeply spiritual level. That's why I give you the point, it's about spiritual union. So here's David's affirmation, and we should imitate him. When in distress and in trouble, I know there are practical problems to solve. You have to attend to the thing. David does that in the very end. Lead me in a plain path, he says, almost at the end of his prayer. He wants to put spiritual union before practical application of his mind to the problem and get perspective and get himself settled and thinking in a faithful way. So we start like that. The Lord is my light. I will lean on him and trust him. And my salvation, whom shall I fear? Calm down. The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? With him I am safe. He is invincible. And then, verse 2, when the wicked, even mine enemies and my foes, came upon me to eat up my flesh, they stumbled and fell. It happened in the past that the most vicious of people who were after my life, not just attacking this land to get territory, but they were most set on getting the life of the king and executing his family and eradicating him. They came upon him to eat up my flesh, which is a figure for personal destruction. They stumbled and fell. I can trust the Lord. He's done it before. Verse 3, though an host should encamp against me. The Hebrew says, though a camp should encamp against me. Sounds like a siege. My heart shall not fear. That fits. A siege must be very terrifying. All around your walls, you see the enemy. There's no way out. There's no escape. They're there. They're camped. They're established. You can't move them. And they're just waiting for you to be starved out. And though war, a different event, a direct assault, should rise against me, in this will I be confident. Full stop. End of thought. What is this in which he will be confident? It is union with God. It starts there. And being in union with him and walking with him, but going into the secret place and reflecting on his power and goodness and opening all up to him and praising him and expressing my love to him, that's the start of all success and remedy. And in that procedure, I'll put my confidence. That's what he says. And then the biggest point of the psalm. One thing, verse 4, the principal thing, he says, the main thing which I desire of the Lord and wish to have from him, and that I'm going to seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. Now, that is obviously not intended as a literal wish. The king cannot move from his house and move into the house of God. He cannot eat and sleep and live and dwell, and yet the language is very strong. That's what he wants to do, to live in the house of the Lord. He cannot mean it literally. So what does he mean? He means that he will always go into the presence of the Lord in a close, to seek and deepen a close personal relationship. His times of prayer will not be just a request list. His times of prayer will not just be emergency askings. There will be times of praise and adoration and communion and reflection, times of thanksgiving. One thing have I desired of the Lord, that will I seek after. Both sides of this are important. We may say this. It is my desire to have close communion with the Lord. And then skip the next few Bible studies and begin to skip personal devotions and cut them down and miss them out and fail in the discipline we need to ensure that we have that time. Well, it's as if David says, this is what I desire of the Lord. But he omits to say, that will I seek after. No, he desires it, and he, in a determined spirit, is going to go into the presence of the Lord, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, every day, to worship him and to know him and to seek his presence, to behold the beauty of the Lord. That's what we do in worship. We're beholding the beauty of the Lord. David has in mind, by way of illustration or figure, going into the temple, looking around at those great reliefs around the walls of the temple, overlaid with gold, with all the symbolism of union with God and harmony, and all the things that reflected the promises of grace. And the temple furniture and the trappings, well, of course, it was the tabernacle in his day, but he would dwell on all these things, and he would think of what they symbolized. Well, we have the substance. We're in a far better position than David. He had only the illustrations, and the altar furniture, and the utensils, all of which had gracious meaning and significance. But he had only the symbols, and we have the reality. So whether your temple is at home, in private devotions, you can reflect on and think about real things that the tabernacle furnishings only represented. You have much more perfect revelation of what Christ has done and all his ways. We love that. People say to me, they love to hear, though they've read it many times, the Gospels read in public services, when they're not even called upon necessarily to read for themselves, but they can just listen to those tremendous accounts of Christ's compassion and his goodness, and they worship and give thanks to God. That's the spirit. That's much better than being in the ancient tabernacle, reading it from pictures, remembering their meaning and their significance, the symbols of grace. So whether your tabernacle of the Lord is at home or whether it's in worship with the people of God, we behold the beauty of the Lord and we inquire in his temple. That's what it's all about. Verse 4 is about union with God, reflecting upon Christ and upon his works. Verse 5, this is a, a wonderful, wonderful verse, but it is somewhat mystical and deeply spiritual. For in the time of trouble, what will he do? David isn't going to rush on and say, in the time of trouble, he will deliver me. In the time of trouble, my foes will buckle, and somehow we shall get the victory even against superior forces. For the moment, he's lost all interest in that. He's now talking about union with God. For in the time of trouble, he shall hide me in his pavilion. And the word translated there, pavilion, there are one or two versions. Have a shot at this. And they call it his hut. Whatever is that doing there? His hut. Actually, the Hebrew uses a word which means woven. It's a kind of woven hut. Some think this is the sort of little place or room made up of woven sheets of or pieces of wood woven together that would be taken in portable form when the king went to war, and whereas everyone else was in the open, he would have this portable kind of hut, mini place to rest in, to confer with his fellow generals in, and things like that. Well, that's very likely what it refers to. But it refers to a little hut made of woven grass or wood or whatever. In the time of trouble, he shall hide me in his pavilion. Can you see the idea? The idea of his intimacy. All right, figuratively, and perhaps literally, I'm in the middle of a battle, and there's great movements on the battlefield, and things are going on, and we're worn out, and we've moved considerable distances. But now it's time for conference, and it's time for the king and his generals to go aside, and they gather in this place. They might well have done it in a tent, but here they're doing it in a woven hut. And it means there'll be intimate counsel there. They may be resting, reflecting on what's taken place, but intimate counsel. In the context and following verse 4, this is with the King of Kings, with the Lords. In the time of trouble, now war has become only a figure for something much deeper. He shall hide me in his pavilion. I shall go into the secret place in the midst of my troubles, and I shall confer with the Lord and praise him and worship him and know his nearness and his strength in my heart. And then the verse goes on, in the secret of his tabernacle. Now the hut has become a tabernacle. Oh, this is not literally a way at war in this verse. The tabernacle, the place of worship, in the secret place with the Lord, it's like being in the place full of symbols where I love to be, in the secret, under the cover of his tabernacle, shall he hide me. This is tremendous language. Conceal me in safety and secrecy. He shall set me up upon a rock. Now the thought is repeating, which occurred earlier, as the result of communion with him, close communion with him, when I emerge, it will be, I will feel so different. It will be as though I am on the top of a high rock or cliff, looking down upon my problems, my enemies in the valley. Now I'm much more assured. I can see how small they are. I can see they're defeatable, be they people in war or temptations with which I'm assailed. I'm given strength and I stand above them and look over them. It almost anticipates the victory. He shall set me up upon a rock. And this hurried jumbling of metaphors, you see, it has that spiritual sense. From the secret place to the place of being assured and victorious. Verse 6, and now shall mine head be lifted up above mine enemies round about me. Therefore will I offer in his tabernacle sacrifices of joy. I will sing, yea, I will sing praises unto the Lord. It's an illustration of spiritual victory. But how did it happen? By going into the secret place, into the intimacy of that hut or tent, that conference, into the presence of God. How important it is to us that spiritual victory comes from union with Christ. That's what this whole psalm is about. Verse 7 begins the prayer. So right down to verse 7, verses 1 to 6, are an affirmation of the paramount importance of close union. Not just hasty prayers, not just requests, but praise and reflection and love expressed to him and thanksgiving. Verse 7 on is the prayer. Hear, O Lord, when I cry with my voice. Have mercy also upon me and answer me. In all David's psalms, when he prays, he never forgets repentance. Have mercy upon me is right there at the beginning of the prayer. He doesn't come proudly ever. Verse 8, when thou saidst, you see the italics, the translators are supplying words to give us the sense, and I'm sure it's just the perfect way of doing it here. There are other ways of doing it. I haven't seen anything so relevant to the psalm as this. When thou saidst, seek ye my face, my face. When, Lord, thou didst say, come really close. Come near. Humble yourself. Speak to me. Praise me. Tell me your love for me. Thank me. See my goodness. See my power. Reflect upon these things. When thou saidst, seek ye my face, my heart, says David. My heart, not just my voice. I really sincerely meant this. Said unto thee, thy face, Lord, close proximity will I seek. That's what we need to say. Thy face, Lord, will I seek every day, at some time. Not let anything get in the way. Whenever, unless unusual circumstances prevent us, the gathering time of the Lord's people, thy face, Lord, will I seek. We don't say that enough to the Lord. Verse 9, hide not thy face far from me. I do not deserve it, David seems to say. The privilege of close audience. I do not deserve the smile of God. Put not thy servant away in anger. I don't come self-righteously. I come conscious that this is grace altogether. Thou hast been my help. This is what gives me courage to come, Lord. I have been helped before and given the blessings of fellowship. Leave me not, neither forsake me, O God of my salvation. Can you see the arguments sitting there in the verse? The arguments are, I come boldly because I've been helped before. And you are the God of my salvation. How can I be abandoned, undeserving as I may be? That's the sense of the verse. And then verse 10. When my father and my mother forsake me. Well, David's father was Jesse. There's not a hint in the record that Jesse ever forsook him. I don't suppose he did for one moment. But there was a time when Jesse grew old, and he was certainly not able to follow after David even when he was young and defend him when he was running away from Saul under persecution in the wilderness, let alone following into subsequent difficulties in the royal court when there were betrayals and problems. in the battles. He couldn't do that. He was now an old man, an infirm. Perhaps it was such a moment that David had in mind, when my father and mother can't provide me with the more intimate kindness and family love and friendship that I might have had earlier. It's an illustration for something which you won't get necessarily or expect from your boss, but you expect from your family, hopefully. But time moves on. It isn't available to you. You can't have it. And they've passed on anyway. But you're not dependent even on that. The Lord will take me up. The Hebrew, as your margin reference tells you, actually says, the Lord will gather me in. Gather me in where? Heaven, say some people. No, no, no. It'll be in the context of the psalm. Gather me into that hut, that secret place, that tabernacle, that place of communion. David hasn't lost the point. When I have no other source of intimate friendship or closeness or encouragement, the figure being parental, then the Lord will gather me in. Please, that hut is still in mind, the place of intimate fellowship. Teach me thy way, O Lord, verse 11. Lead me in a plain path because of mine enemies. Only now are we down to practicalities. Deliver me not over unto the will of mine enemies, verse 12, for false witnesses are risen up against me, and such as breathe out cruelty. That could be Absalom's rebellion, we don't deny it. But you notice how the prayer was much more concerned about the close relating to the Lord as the chief source of strength and comfort and perspective before he ever came to any practical petitions. And that's the whole point of the psalm. And then the testimony. And we've got some words supplied by the translators, which are implied in the Hebrew but not stated. Verse 13, I had fainted. I was overwhelmed and would have been unless I had believed to see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait on the Lord, the exhortation. Wait on him. Very strange root the word has. It, wait on the Lord means trust him. But it has a strange root. And again, it's the weaving root. It's things that are woven together or plaited together. Well, that's not what it means here, but you can see the kind of waiting or trusting that is in mind. Wait on the Lord as if you are one bound to him. Your trust is so strong. Wait as one so dependent. You're intertwined with him. That emerges from close fellowship. Be of good courage, and he shall strengthen thine heart. Wait in that woven sense, I say, on the Lord. Well, dear friends, that to my mind is David, the psalmist, the king, speaking about close union and relationship with the Lord. We've seen that he affirms it, then he prays for it, then he gives the exhortation on the end, how important it is to us. Union with him is what we're called to. Union with him makes it much harder to sin. Union with him opens the door to instrumentality and usefulness and answered prayer and the provision of assurance. So, when you pray, and I'm sure you do this, but how we all need to do it much more often, see yourself as going into union with the Lord, close counsel and fellowship, shut in with him, express your love, thank him for all you can, and make that even more than the asking, and he'll bless you, and he'll reward you, and he'll draw near to you. Let's close this evening singing the hymn 588. Hymn number 588.